Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin. Each episode, I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalize on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them that it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a breakup. Games often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, as I search for my perfect console. My guest today is a stand-up comedian, television presenter, and Irish national treasure. He studied mathematics and theoretical physics at University College Dublin, where, during a debate, he cracked a joke, made the audience laugh, and forever doomed himself to chasing that high. Since then, he has toured the world as a comic, as well as becoming a prolific television host. He has chaired Mock the Week, Have I Got News for You, Blockbusters, Robot Wars, Stargazing Live, and the video game-themed quiz show Go 8-Bit. A lifelong game player, he regularly hosts the video game BAFTAs and performs games-related routines in his stand-up. I'm very proud to be a gamer, although I understand it's embarrassing, he once said. If I'm at a dinner party and someone goes, how do you relax after a gig? It's less awkward if I say I masturbate to hardcore pornography. Welcome, Dara O'Brien.
Yeah, I'd even forgotten the end of that line. It is quite a slap in the face.
I think that was part of a stand-up routine you did coming on for 15 years ago. Do you think attitudes have changed now? If you were to tell people that you play games, would they be quite so shocked?
Well, it was interesting watching that phenomena over the last while. I mean, I think if that was in the routine that became the video game routine, that was certainly felt like an interesting moment because we all shied away from doing routines about it because the specificity of it we didn't think would translate across. Mm. But slowly, because I hosted a load of BAFTA Game Awards and they had me do press, and the press at the start of doing it was very, oh, isn't this a hobby that only teenage boys, that kind of thing. And you go, and I'd trot out it's a larger creative industry than movies and books and whatever. I never quite had the full stats to back that up. And then one day we were doing an interview with Sky News on the afternoon of it. And I think they probably captured my surprise because the host, I don't remember who it was, said, and I was at the Video Game Awards. Do you know what I hate? He says, it's when you're online and you're playing and then he's going to get into a really specific situation. I went, yeah, that is irritating, isn't it? And like, he was like, but it wasn't like, oh, what's games? It was like, oh man, I know. Oh, I'm such a noob. It was just like, oh, okay. So we're able to just talk about this perfectly normally. It is. I mean, it's a while since you had one of the guests would come out on those awards and go, Oh, I love Pac-Man or something equally jarring. The people that go, what?
I told a story years ago about being at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. The Edinburgh Television Festival. And there was a seminar or whatever about video games. There's somebody on from, is it Take-Two who make the Lego games?
Traveller's Tales.
Traveller's Tales. Somebody else talking about how we want to make a Doctor Who game and using IP across things, whatever. And there was a producer that had this, in a really weary kind of a, oh, okay, I'll bite. How much will it cost to make a game? And the guy from Traveller's Tales went, okay, well, so there'll be 60 to 100 people for a year and a half. That'll be about $100 million. So that, like, this look of, and I remember almost jumping in going, yeah, you make their shows. They don't make your game. I think there's been a lack of understanding of just how massive both the effort to make them is and their reach.
It's sort of all changed so quickly. I remember when you did your video game routine and it goes onto YouTube. This must have been around 2010. And it felt sort of momentous. It was the first time, I think, people who play games and love games had seen someone off the telly doing observational comedy about, about, like you say, something as specific as Solid Snake from Metal Gear or something like that. Do you remember the first time you tried that routine? Were you a bit nervous that it was too specific?
Yeah, I was. I was. I thought I didn't know where to stick in the show, and then realised it very quickly became, this is the closer.
There's a game called Metal Gear Solid where you play a character called Snake.
Yes.
And when Snake dies, the camera pulls cinematically up from above him, and the voice of the man Snake has been speaking to on his comms unit goes, Snake, Snake, Snake! Every time he dies. When I play as Snake, he dies a lot. But the man's sadness seems undiminished by the regularity with which he has to mourn Snake. You think once or twice he'd go, ah, Snake.
It was a very pleasing sense of, because actually, weirdly, you can't do movies that way because you could never presume everyone's seen the same bit of a movie.
Right.
And even increasingly in the last while, because movies have become even more disparate and basically siloed away in different streaming services and stuff. So people only get a vague sense of what certain films are. So doing a bit that was specifically to the finale bit of a Japanese action game. The trick, by the way, there's a lot of, how much information can I give you for you to get this despite not knowing the artifact on which it's based? I mean, in the same show, there was a routine about the film 2012, and absolutely people had not seen 2012.
Right.
And the first night I did the tour was in Stoke. A man in the front row midway through the 2012 routine raised his hand, and I had to stop and go, yes? And he said, I haven't seen this film. And I said, well, look, just sit it out then. I don't know. It was kind of like we didn't want to do it. I mean, there was nothing fundamental to it. But, like, yeah, no, very, very quickly realized, oh, no, this is, I've hit something here. And and people, at the very least, have looked over the shoulder of people if they haven't played themselves and have seen the motion of these characters.
How did you pick the games that you were going to focus on? Did you try out different ones and see which resonated?
I don't remember marketing that specifically and going, oh, well, let's try, Final Fantasy, but that's too obscure. No, I think, yeah. It had the basic premise, which I think was an easy explained one, and which was it locks off access to further parts in a way that other media doesn't. That was the thesis of the routine. If we're getting really lofty about this, that was the thesis of the routine. My proof went to Guitar Hero, which I think enough people knew about, and was able to therefore mention bands.
Right.
And that was the stuff from that blow, like whatever. And then into, for some reason, had a jab at Nintendo in the middle of the routine. Because years I've done the routine, so I've forgotten there's a bit, middle bit I can't remember, because I had some jab about, there's a unicorn that shits out rainbows.
Yes.
Onto a thing.
Yeah, you're being rude about Wii games, I think.
Wii games. Everything's so twee. it's really, and then you have to make the rainbows go everywhere. And then it was into Metal Gear Solid. But the, you'd never pick Metal Gear Solid now as being there. Call of Duty should have been it, really.
Yeah, well, I didn't do Call of Duty, I have no idea. But I just think I just left the shouting, Nick, in an increasingly panicked voice.
Call of Duty is almost too popular, too mainstream, isn't it?
It is.
It's like doing a bit on Big Brother or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it'd be hack to have done that, where it was kind of cool to do the other one. But I do remember once we had a, on one of the BAFTAs, we had the voice actor from one of the Call of Duties who came out and came out to a polite round of applause and then leaned into the mic and went, come with me if you want to live. And everyone went,
Okay, so the premise of the podcast is I'm going to ask you to pick the five games you want to put on your fictional games machine and mark it to the world. Can you tell us about your first choice and what was going on in your life when you first encountered it?
Well, I thought the only way to do this is chronologically, to force you onto a journey. It being a podcast, of course. Quite relatively recently, I bought one of those machines that has everything on it.
Right.
And got one made. Weirdly, with the money from Go 8-Bit, I bought an arcade machine and then got them to push the 8-bit representations of all of our contestants as back into the machine. And then I got them to do family portraits in 8-bit. So I've got all myself, my wife, my three kids are in 8-bit.
Oh, that's so nice.
I know, I love that too, but they have never been that impressed by it. Like, and it's really, oh, you live in a world of wonders. I had the thought of my own father bringing back, here is an 8-bit representation of you. In what I thought, when I turned the thing on, then I thought, oh, well, what's going to be the most evocative for me? And Pac-Land was the one that I started playing first. I never liked Pac-Man or Miss Pac-Man. Never got the point of that at all. I still don't. I think it's a ridiculous game. Genuinely, I've never got the as a thing. But Pac-Land was the expansion into a kind of a Nintendo-ish kind of side-scrolling adventure game. Which had this piece of music. Which for 40 years has been in my head and will never leave. And I could sing at the drop of a hat, Pac-Land tune. And then which Pac-Man runs through a little town which has all the ghosts in it, and he has to get past the ghosts and then go to a forest and a village. It's a good little game. It's very nice kind of thing. But the bit that totally blew my mind about it, and this must be when I was 13, 14, maybe a little bit older. I watched somebody play it once, and there's a bit where you run through a little village. There's ghosts are floating above your head, and you've got to avoid them when you jump. And there's also fire hydrants, and you've got to avoid the fire hydrants. The fire hydrants can shoot out water that pushes you along, possibly into a ghost. And then you get to the last fire hydrant. And then I remember watching somebody else play it, some older boy play it. And he got to the last fire hydrant, and he turned around and ran backwards, which was, you know, unusual in a side scroller anyway. And then when he ran backwards, the fire hydrant moved slightly. And when it moved like a full, like, unit across, a little hat came out of it, ding, and landed on his head, and now he could headbutt the ghosts. And that's an Easter egg. There's no reason for you to have got that. That's really sweet. That was a really nice thing to do. And you kind of going, I like an Easter egg. It's quite clever. But also, how the hell did he know? And now I knew, and this is pre-internet, and I had no sense of. That was the moment where I thought, well, someday there will be a... I went spiraling into a vision where I went, someday computers will link all of us and we will know all this stuff. I went, how do we know? How did anyone get that information out that, other than by some mad word of mouth? There's no Pac-Land magazine. And I've always been amazed by how the word got out that you could do that and you could find that little thing. The word got out and got to Bray County Wicklow in Ireland, which is a long way from Tokyo. Difficult to express how not Tokyo the small Irish town I grew up in is. Small seaside resort that had a couple of arcades they grew up in. Small, permanently out of season seaside resort that I grew up in. Like every day is like Sunday type seaside resort. And how that hot information from a Japanese games developer got to me blew my mind at the day.
Yes, it feels like you're sharing a secret with someone on the other side of the world, doesn't it? When you find a designer's trick like that or Easter egg, like you say, amazing. So you had these arcades in Bray where you grew up. When I was very young, arcades had this, I suppose, a slightly seedy feel to them, or certainly like that was the view of some adults in my life. Were you allowed to visit them? Did your parents like encourage all of that?
I wouldn't say they encouraged it. There was, firstly, there were parts of the feature of the town. There was Dawson's and the Star. Musings were the two big ones. Dawson's in the middle of the problem, Star down at the end. And there's another one as well that was never forgotten. There was two down the one end and one in the middle. The Star was the best and they had the best machines. I don't remember ever being told, don't go in there. No, that's where bad kids go, get tattoos and don't get a good leaving cert. I don't think it was ever warned like that, particularly in comparison to other things in the town, which were really
right,
rough.
Right, yeah, yeah. The arcade was the sanctuary, the safe place.
Oh, very much so. It was where the Sharks and the Jets could finally gather together around the ER Kung Fu machine. And
trade Pacland tips.
It was like the owner would go, this is sacred ground. No blood can be spilled on this ground. And then we'd come in and we played Pac-Land together.
Do you remember when you got your first video game machine in your actual house, so you didn't have to go out?
Yes, I do. And I also remember meeting my father as he walked back with us, because in August, we were in England on holidays. He'd gone to an Argos to get an Atari as a Christmas present. And I remember bumping into him, because I'd run out to see him or he didn't know he was out, and he was carrying this big box and he was like, no.
You ruined the surprise.
But yet, still made us wait 5 months to give us the Atari. Even though I knew what it was, I had to wait until 25th of December to get the Atari and go, oh, wow, look what a fantastic, what a surprise this is.
Thank you, Santa.
Yes, and I could have been playing this for the last 5 months. And it was a proper, it was a Trey 600 with wood sidings, which is amazing design choice, that we're going to make this look like a Studebaker or something like that. It's going to have like fake pine on the edges of it. We built then for Go 8-Bit, the short-lived but fondly remembered video game show I did. We built as a prop an 8-foot-tall version of the Atari joystick. And I have no idea where that is. It's somewhere in existence. There is an 8-foot-tall. There's like also a 10-foot-wide Nintendo SNES controller, but somewhere, and there's nowhere in the house that it wouldn't really stand out like that giant penny in Batman's lair, there's an Olmec head in the Simpsons basement that's never explained.
Yeah, you need that in your garden, a water feature or something.
Just like with something with stuff draped on, and go, is that 8 foot tall original Atari choice? Yes, never speak of it again.
Well, let's come to your second choice for that, your perfect console.
Yes, jumping past the VIC-20, then went to the cavernous memory of the Commodore 64. Genuine classic games. So the one I've chosen for that is Impossible Mission.
Another visitor. Stay a while. Stay forever.
You know the way that if you buy emulators, you're essentially trying to get that Proustian rush, that sense of being 14 again or 19 or 70, whatever age you was, and you play, you want just for a second to taste life afresh again. And I tried to do that a lot with both Impossible Mission and Boulder Dash, which were the two kind of iconic games of my generation and that, like the. And I've played many terrible versions, particularly of Boulder Dash. Diamond Run, Rock Quest.
Oh, you mean like rip-offs?
Rip-off, very fine. And then eventually found one that was on that Commodore 64 emulator, and you can plug a proper joystick into it, and played it recently and sank into a brass off. Oh, this is my youth. That's it. There's the mouthfeel of the first Ratatouille I ate that my mother gave me. That's what the hope is. But they're both great games. Impossible Mission to me slightly shaded it because I had to map it. It was quite a clever thing. You'd load it and the first time you played it was always the same, and then they'd scatter and change the room. But then you could play it, map the room out, try to defeat it, try to get the puzzle pieces to add together to make Swordfish, which is the code to get into it. Yes, but you did. But unfortunately, what is the reference with Swordfish? Because then that turned up in...
Oh gosh, I'm not sure.
Swordfish is the word you had to get an Impossible Mission. And then in that, the film which should be that heist movie with John Travolta in which Halle Berry went topless. That film where Hugh Jackman goes undercover, or he's a hacker. And am I missing a reference, or is that a quite Impossible Mission joke? It was about hacking, and it was about all that, you know, stuff of breaking into, and you had to need a code and whatever. But unless there's somebody could tell there's a richer kind of, well, actually Swordfish was even a reference in Impossible Mission. But Swordfish is the word you had to get. And it had speech, the game, which I still remember because you turn it on and... Elvin, I think, was the bad guy who was a scientist who was, you know, had plans to destroy the world, would go, another visitor. stay a while, stay forever. Which means that he used to pipe that into his corridor, into his lairs, a PA system that he would say that through. And then you'd run through it. And the animation was mind-blowing. It was a smooth, it remains among the best animation. It was a smooth little running. That for some reason you were running on sand. The Foley work was insane because you ran, it used to go as on each footstep, which was the Foley of a sand, which makes no sense at all. You're in his lair. And it's unlikely that he said, I have robots, I have floating robots. What they need is a sand base on which to operate. Not smooth, polished tile, which is obviously what you'd make.
Yes, right.
But they chose sand.
Maybe they'd all go back from the beach. They just had lunch there or something.
Yeah, and so slowly they'd walk sand into the place. That's what they'd done. Over time, sand had just been brushed into the place because it was just off the beach, because that's the one thing you like. Because it's on an island. Of course, it's on an island.
There
somewhere.
We go.
Yeah. They dropped him into an island. Yeah. And then Elden kept walking sand in and going, oh. But it had robots that tied it up. There were robots among the robots. There were a number of robots. There were really angry robots that fired lasers. Okay, straight at you and fired lasers. And then there was robots who just buzzed around slowly. And it seemed to be robots who just tied it up. But the graphic style of it was lovely. They brought out the sequel to it, weirdly, in which they ruined it. Absolutely ruined it. It's like they had a great colour scheme and everything, and they went, no, that's not enough. We must make it puce. And we make it an angry red with a kind of a strong yellow. And this looks worse. The first one looked like it was from another generation of computers.
Right.
And it was that thing of going, oh my God, how are they doing this? That's the most incredible thing.
Yeah.
This looks photorealistic. It was not photorealistic. It was clearly 8-bit. But this looks unbelievable as a thing. And just having him run around on the sandy corridors, just the smoothness of his stride, the end, which actually now is quite balletic and maybe a little over-mannered, which is unusual. But at the time, it was so smooth. It was just mind-blowing. You can just make him somersault around the corridors all the time. Just to go, this is so beautiful.
Those sort of huge graphical leaps, they just don't happen so much anymore. For I imagine children now, you know, you still get games that look very pretty, but back then it was such monumental changes, wasn't it, between games?
I subscribed to Zap 64, which was the British video game Commodore 64, the iconic kind of Commodore 64 magazine. Not as common in some ways in a small group of people as Commodore User, because a guy I know once brought a porn mag back from England, smuggled into the school inside the pages of a Commodore User magazine, and then was followed around for the entire day by the rest of the class shouting, we all want to see your Commodore User, which was really quick. They wrote the song really fast and it scanned perfectly.
Quick, we need a song.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the Terraces or something, like whatever. They very immediately worked out a number. We got to get a number to sum up our feelings about this. What do we want to do? Want to see his Commodore User? Okay, let's do this rhythm. And so wrote a tune, we always see a Commodore User, which remains with me to this day. But anyway, Zap 64 was the more legit, less, you know, porn enveloping magazine that we read. Zap used to have a bit, they'd have ratings and it's playability or graphics was one of them. And like it was things would either have amazing graphics or bad graphics, in the way that now would it feels more like cinematography. It's like sitting in the cinema going, ooh, the graphics of this are very good.
I wish film critics did do that. That would be great.
If you had to do graphics, sound.
Graphics on Titanic.
To be honest, actually, do you know, I watched a bit of the last Jurassic Park recently and
had bad graphics.
Graphics are bad. I mean, that as a phrase, that's so evocative to me. I mean, the movie's not bad, but the graphics aren't great. There should be more of that, but that kind of like, oh my God, the graphics are incredible, and you just buy a thing almost just to see how good the graphics were. That was an actual consideration at the end. I mean, look, God of War Ragnarok is very beautiful. It's very, very, and you can see it's very, you know, renders gorgeously and very deep landscape and all that, like whatever, but it's not like you just now, sadly, I suppose you just presume it, which is unfortunately the person who is designing the Leaf asset.
Right.
I'm going, it's just presumed that this is all going to be amazing.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You were like clearly a smart student at school, and you go on to study maths and physics at uni. Was there any part of you that was interested in going into game development?
No, I think it was only later I kind of went, oh, well, that'd be interesting. How would you put that with that? I think I had that thing of not knowing how these things were even created, that somebody made a decision about them, like whatever. That way that I am, what does the director do? My son, for example, my 11-year-old son is really into games, but all games, board games, card games, all that kind of stuff, like whatever. And I could see that he would very much like to construct and change rules and move things around.
Be a game designer.
Yeah. Like on the Commodore 64, I think I wrote an adventure game that was had two steps as a proof of concept.
Do you remember what you had to do?
You had to pick up something and go left. I think I was essentially it.
Pick up key, go left.
Use key. Okay, bango. Ta-da, you win. Good, great. Even programming itself, I never went beyond Dara is cool. We'd go to 10, print Dara is cool, go to 10. Which is kind of weird, I suppose, because I love maths and physics and things like that. I can solve those kind of problems.
And, you know, the story that I referenced in the introduction, was it really sort of this light bulb moment where I believe you were in the middle of a debate or something and you got a laugh? Do you remember what exactly happened?
University debating in Irish universities is a big kind of big deal, and it's a big communal event. They get guests in and politicians and journalists come and speak in the universities. There'd be a Thursday night meeting and a Friday night meeting in the big lecture halls, and 600 people would pile in and they would have these public meetings. And I remember sitting at the back of these. It was the thing that was not in my, it was that thing that felt most like this is university. This defines university to me at the time. Following year, did the freshers competition in second year, which is not a thing you know, you're supposed to do the year before, and I did in second year. And then wrote a joke at the very start about they'd moved the law faculty to a different building. And the law faculty used to be in the same building as arts. And so they were very involved in the center of the university. And then they got shifted out to this other building at the far end of the campus. And they're all grumbling about that. And I open with some line about, thank you very much. Lovely to be here. And love to see you all here. A special thanks to our friends from law who've traveled so far to be with us today. And that got a massive laugh and a big round of applause. And it was like a spike going off, an adrenaline spike in a part of my brain that's never, you know, whoa, what was that?
Right, that coming online.
What was that? And I even remember the before I thought of that line was the day before walking along. And I remember walking on the concourse in the university and going, oh, I've traveled so far. Oh, yeah, I could do that. And that moment, that was the first gag I ever wrote. And and in context, obviously, it sounds insanely small and specific now, but it got a huge surge, and I went, oh, that's good. I'll get more of that. And then it kind of all went from there. And now I need to do 2 hours of like killer material. And everything has to land. And then it has to be 15, 20 minutes of off the cuff stuff that I have to recap at the end for me to sit at the end and go, yeah, those are actually all right.
Okay, let's. Why don't we take a break and come to your third game on your console? Can you tell us about it?
When I went to university, did no gaming at all. And there's 5 years I was in university. That's longer than normal, Dara. Yes, I ran a newspaper for a while. No, but even then, Dara, that seems longer than... Yeah, okay, right. I did my finals twice. Long story. So I had a circuitous route to university in which I shifted. The person who came out was very different. The person who came in was running newspapers and doing gigs and all this kind of stuff. But it meant that I was in a total bubble in the university I was in. And so among the things I absolutely miss are 5 seasons of the Premier League. Take that. Wow, that went past me completely. other musical things, whatever. Just about Kurt Cobain just came in and rave hit him. But I was in a total bubble of things and consoles. So people get very misty-eyed about the late 80s, early 90s kind of like SNES and all that stuff. got and didn't play any of those. After I left university in 95, I got a job as a children's television presenter. And I said, oh, we should have a thing about video games on this. And they were like, huh? And I said, why don't I contact and see if we can get it? And I got a PlayStation 1 from Sony. Geez, why I didn't just then, well, now I'm going to ring Nintendo. I'm going to ring all of them. And because they habitually do. Yeah, of course, absolutely. Here's the thing for, we're going to be on the telly at a kids. But yeah, of course, here. And here's the game. And then they would send me games. And we had this video game section, which is all about just Sony, because that's the only phone call I made. And I would just do things about Sony. Got Tekken 2, which we couldn't show the kids anyway, and an ISS Pro. ISS Pro, such. Again, I remember it the way I remember playing football as now, as a 51-year-old man, I remember my playing football as being incredibly competent and smooth and striking your ball beautifully and these things happening. And I remember ISS Pro being that as well. It's how I remember I used to dance magically and brilliantly. And ISS Pro was like that. It was just a smooth thing that... The through ball, the through ball was the most beautiful mechanic ever. Because we played, you know, various soccer sims and they were clunking. Or you'd come in at a certain diagonal and that would go straight into net all the time. And you'd learn to hack the game in certain ways. And then this thing, you'd move slightly to the left and knock a through ball. And then you'd run onto the ball. It was like, what the hell is it? You were Redondo, who was obviously Ronaldo, but it was Redondo. And Redondo would stride through and knock it through. And then you'd get the replay and you'd spin the camera around and watch the replay again of it going in.
Yeah.
And it was just beautiful.
It's difficult. Younger sort of listeners probably, you know, won't realize this, but at that time, Konami that also makes Metal Gear Solid, their ISS Pro series, or Pro Evolution as it became, was really the dominant. That was the one, if you cared about football games, it was way better than FIFA. But of course, that's very different today.
Yeah, it is. I mean, like, it's weird, and it's interesting to track the point where FIFA took over. But at the time, FIFA was very much regarded, the EA Games FIFA was very much regarded as full kit wanker. As just had bought the jersey and strode around. Look at me! I've got all the stuff. I've got the socks and the shirt, like whatever. It was the rich kid whose dad bought them all the stuff, but were rubbish at the game. Couldn't play the game at all.
Yeah, because it had all the licenses, all the real names. Yeah,
absolutely, and all that. So it had the proper names. You could actually be Ronaldo, but the actual game was terrible by comparison. But also, in FIFA, there was a commentary was better, and it was actual commentators. Whereas, like, it was like all the commentary in Pro Evolution was translated directly from Japanese. I run through Google Translate and then read out. There was one I remember. The game would start, and the game would start. They would go, "The sun is up, and the wind is shooting through the stadium."
Yeah, it's a blast on the path.
And it was like, "There's none of that makes sense." Why would you go, "Well, the sun is up," like, let alone that the wind is shooting through the stadium? You never go, "What a day we have! We weren't expecting the sun to be up today, but it's up, and the wind." Just a bizarre. No, why was that afraid? There was always the mythic thing that you could unlock two girls commentating on it. Do you remember that? Was that it? Two disinterested women talking about the match. And if that's never been done, I mean, obviously, this spoke of a time where it was like entirely a male enclave and all that. But the idea was somewhere locked into this software, they'd record an entire suite of just two women. I don't know, what's happened now?
Is the sun up?
Yeah, I know, but the wind is shooting through the stadium. It was a beautiful game to play. It was absolutely gorgeous because sometimes you could split the defense and then you're through. Oh, it was lovely.
Yeah, amazing.
Lovely.
Yeah. So you were recently on Taskmaster, and one of the challenges for that was to bring in the thing that you would most like to have with you on a car journey, and you brought in a suitcase containing a video game console. Is that, you know, when you're off touring, do you actually do that?
I have, yeah. That was bought for me by a comedian friend of mine, Ed Byrne, for my 40th birthday.
Oh, it was actually yours.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's very definitely mine. And I brought it home. I don't know if I won the episode, but I certainly wasn't letting anyone have it. It's a hard shell, like a sound engineer's kind of thing that you'd see occasionally on a baggage reclaim. But within it, there's a 20-inch LCD screen. Kind of you need a power source. So it's on a train journey, you can plug it in and play it, which gets some looks. It's amazing. There are newer versions of them because that one's like 11 years old now. But it still works. And so I play it at halftime in the dressing rooms.
Would you play when you fire it up?
Yeah, it would be football. It would have been FIFA. It would have been something like that you can play. But I don't think it's in the when you're grabbing moments of things, you wouldn't go for 10 minutes before the gig is the time to start Bloodborne or something. I was looking at the shelves that I had there for the last. It's just going. Am I missing anything talking here about games? And I think I have. There's a run of FIFAs that I have. After shifted to FIFA, there's a period where I had all of the FIFAs and I'm going, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. But even now, I think I've got 23 and 21. And you'd think I'd be very good at it, but actually I remain semi-pro and my 11-year-old has just gone professional.
Right.
And I'm very much in that moment. You're catching me exactly the moment where can't quite beat him and it's driving me up the wall. And I was comfortably holding him at arm's length for a while. And then I would have to play, he'd play Real Madrid and I'd play Bray Wanderers, which is the local League of Ireland team from the town I'm from. And they were on the machine for a while.
Oh, they were?
Yeah. And so we would play and I would have that handicap and I'd still beat him. And now...
You're playing as Brazil now.
I'm playing as that legends team that's been buried somewhere. I unlocked that team. And then I play as that, and he has to be Sligo Rovers. I feel, you know, the autumn of my years approaching as he slowly goes. At some point, he'll go, I hear Dad, here, you have a go. I feel like I see that happening.
FIFA's causing you some existential dread at the moment.
Oh, no, it is. It is all of the things. I mean, I don't know what the normal one, you know, is it an arm wrestle? Is it a sprint? What is it that, you know, I used to be able to do this with my son, but then I'm handing the baton over, and my baton is FIFA.
You mentioned your friend Ed Byrne, a fellow comedian. I've read in the past that you used to play online games with him sometimes. Do you still do that? Do you still play online, or are you more of a solitary?
Okay, it's difficult to coordinate these things as a comedian because your hours are kind of weird. We played a lot of Halo, the first Halo. There was an arena that had this looping thing that went over the top of it in a valley, but it had this kind of weird circular thing like the arch at Wembley in the middle of it, and we played a lot on that. Guy, his brother, God love him, passed away. Paul Byrne died last year, but yeah, he said the thing we found amazing was when the person you're playing with's voice would come out of the television, and we were like, and Ed said that was amazing, and his brother said, yeah, I'm fucking sick of Darwin's voice coming out of my television, which was quite a deaf joke by Paul. But look, we're older men with responsibilities.
Yeah, of course, you know, of course,
yeah.
Okay, let's turn to your fourth game. Can you tell us about it?
Was Arkham Asylum. Arkham Asylum was Xbox 360 and the first of a run of just exceptional Batman games that probably, for whatever reason, I think I was just triggered a period in my life where I suddenly began to finish some games. I'd finish long games, one or two a year, and it was the first because it got me and was doable. There were no things I love about it. A, the environment changed. There were like three or four central buildings, but they would change because Poison Ivy would come in at some point and then and would spread, and suddenly bits that were closed were open and bits that were open were closed. That blows my mind. I think it's fantastic when they do that. It's equally when they incorporate some scarecrow would give you some sort of drug thing, and then suddenly the whole landscape would change just because you were in a hallucination. Corridors would spin away from you, like whatever. Those kind of animation trick combined with an interactive medium, I think, are fantastic. And you're kind of going, okay, this is the thing that nothing else can do this. Nothing else can create the universe and then change and warp the universe in front of you while you're doing that. I think that stuff is very, very, when that's done well, when the waters rise in God of War and suddenly there's a whole series of stuff that wasn't accessible, suddenly accessible, that kind of stuff. Like that. And so I Arkham Asylum did it extremely well. But also the basic mechanic of fighting was really straightforward and it did all the thinking for you. Oh, would you like me to punch somebody? Okay, I'll punch somebody. Oh, would you like me to kick somebody? Fine, I'll kick somebody. Now I'll block. But it wasn't like...
It wasn't Street Fighter, was it?
It was Street Fighter, wasn't it? Wasn't, you die. You could happily button mash and get through it. And also the stealth element. Jesus, there's so much that's great about that. Somebody's made a good point about The Last of Us television thing going out. If there isn't an episode of The Last of Us where Joel just sits under a table for 45 minutes while the clicker walks in a set pattern, then that is not an accurate rendition. Because that's all I did. I love it, and it freaks me out. Stealth stuff like when the S is gone, I just go, oh. And the stealth parts of that, particularly, I would go, ah, quickly, quick, bang.
Yeah.
spin. I thought it was a beautifully balanced game. It was also the first time I think I ever went, fine, let's collect all 400 or whatever it is of these Riddler trophies.
Right,
And I think actually irritating that when I played it properly, I got 399 of them. But I got one they didn't get, which was on a faraway ridge. You had to go under a little waterfall, and there was one chance to get it. And if you didn't get it then...
I think it was the fact that it was... The world wasn't too massive. So sometimes on these, you know, and even in the later Batman games, you get these massive cities, and you're like, well, there's no way I can collect all of those bits. But if it's sort of narrow but deep, you can... It feels more manageable, perhaps.
Absolutely, and I think there was something about them, the fact that it trembled because every time something else happened, there was an earthquake or something like it would be slightly different again, but recognizable. And I think that was just it was lovely. So it was linear, but it felt loose. That magic of how you keep challenges ticking over, so that you've got stuff going on, but also there's a general narrative drive. It's always very interesting. I do remember making the one where there's lots of, you had to collect everything at the top of all these skyscrapers.
Crackdown,
yeah. And I met with the developers in an airport once and we're chatting about stuff, and he said, look, we put them in to see how far people actually get, you know. That's how that started. So because we obviously get a ping saying, this person collected this, and we see how many stuff, how much it actually gets. And I didn't realize the level to which it is a massive experiment in how far do people actually, or what corners do they visit or not visit, and all that.
You've mentioned briefly your show Go 8-Bit, one of the few video game related TV shows other than Games Master. Why do you think that has not continued, or is it going to continue?
No, it's gone. The reason, it started same time as Taskmaster, interestingly, and for the first series was the hit and Taskmaster wasn't. And we were gung-ho to do another two. It started as comedians around a couch talking shit at each other. And then weirdly, we did it in a studio in London called Fountain Studios that then shut down, and we had to move out to L Street, and they could not get an audience in. And so we found ourselves with 40 people in sometimes, rather than 300. And then they also, there are kind of issues about who they booked in. Stop being comedians. They wanted to get more gel. And some of it made sense. Like Greg Wallace was in. And Greg Wallace has an obsession with certain types of video games, or Jody Kidd, who designs, you know, has designed games computers, is a big mass gamer. That's all grand, but like sometimes it went too far into celebs rather than comedians. And so you lost something essential about it. The intimacy of it being loads of mates trash talking each other in front of 300 people kind of got lost, and the numbers tailed away. And even we felt as we were making it, all the energy is draining out of this now, because we're doing it in front of 60 people. And there was there was one episode where there was an old woman sitting in the audience watching it. And I came out at the end of the show and I said, look, that's great. I hope you enjoyed it. Look, what we're going to do now is stay in your seats. We've got to do a couple of little, what we call pickups at the end of the show, you know, the things that we got to do for editing. So just bear with us while we do that. And the old woman just got up and went, I turned around and walked up the stairs and out of the room. And I watched her do it, and it was both heartbreaking and hilarious. I couldn't, it was just so, I'm not doing that. It was really weird how the ball was dropped in it. I don't know, but it was like, it was a lovely thing that had they just stayed in the same room with the same thing, we could have done that indefinitely. And then it got blown away. I thought it was infinitely renewable, and we had lovely moments of, you know, David James, the England goalkeeper, being beaten by Susan Kalman in an episode, and him being furious in a happy way, but really competitive way. Like, when everything got beaten, and we're going, we got to get these two back together. And they never did. There's like things like that was an obvious thing. Get those two back in for another show. And it was like things that would happen, like whenever the people were being beaten in the last second of races, that we'd go slow down. Let's see that in slow motion where Dink and Drew were. Or, you know, someone would get lost and would drive the wrong way up the track in Rage Racer or whatever, like, and we'd see them going past on the other person's screen, like, just, it was lovely. We could stop and show the highlights of it. Like, there's some lovely things to it. But they just put it, it was in the wrong studio at the wrong time. It was on a Monday night out in Nell Street, which is in Boreham Wood. It's tough to get anyone to drive to come out there. Rather than the middle of town, we got 300 gaming fans in, and they blew it. And it was really, really irritating, because it was a lovely thing.
Yeah, it is a shame.
Yeah.
Frustrating. Like many people who sort of care about games or video games or board games, I sort of love Taskmaster, which you were recently in, of course, and won your series as well.
Thank you. Yes, yes.
I mean, I've got a slight pet theory that Taskmaster's having a reshaping effect on, I guess, like, audience expectations of comedians on TV, because you're shown in situations that we've not really seen comedians before in, like these moments of intimacy and vulnerability, and you get to see your true reactions.
Yes.
As you're being competitive, all of that. And are you... in particular, we're in a slightly unique position because you were on that show when your very long run on Mock the Week ended, or around the same time, you know, which was a more traditional comedy format. Do you think that a shift in audience expectations or tastes influenced that decision to end Mock the Week?
I don't know if it did. I think it got shifted because the BBC has less money and it wants to take the money it has and move it into different forms of entertainment, which is bad news for comedy. So I think they basically went, okay, we've got five panel shows or four panel shows, and we're going to get rid of one of them. And so we were the one that went. So I don't think it's anything. I don't believe there was some shady conspiracy, political conspiracy to get us, because we were too, left-leaning or whatever. Well, certainly in terms of, like, the variety of faces on show, and people, the change in representation of different communities within the comedy world, you can definitely trace that to Mock the Week. And I'm not saying we led that, but it's just the imagination. But but
you reflected it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you see that, but you'd also see the change in tone, because comedy, when we started Mock the Week, was quite club-based, and maybe a little more brutal, a little bit more confrontational, and one-liner based, and here's a sharp take on this, and bang, bang, bang. And then it moved to a much more collaborative, comedy generally moved to a much more collaborative, I'd say, podcast sort of model of people being on each other's shows and being more used to listening and reacting and building funny together type things.
Right.
Took over from, I got my bit, and I've elbowed my way into having my bit, and here's my bit. Taskmaster is in that situation where you put people in different situations, and yeah, you hope you see something of them, rather than their persona that they've created. Certainly, you don't want to do Taskmaster unless you're happy to look ridiculous at some stage. And I am also very aware that I portray a certain high status. I'm hosting shows, I'm handing up points, I'm saying yes or no to things. On stage, I'm in a suit. But most of my stories on stage, for example, are times I have fucked things up or things have gone wrong or whatever, or because I want to undercut that constantly. But I'm aware that I am, you know, a 50-year-old man in a suit standing in front of you telling you things. So I'm already in a certain situation, like, whatever. I'm a 6'4", large man telling you stuff, and you're sitting down and listening to it, like that. So you have an authority there that you can undercut. So it is funny for me to do a moment, for example, in, like, Taskmaster, where I screwed up the thing entirely. I just stood there going, wait, what, wait, what, wait, because I also know that God love us, I'll want to win. Not very good. So, yeah. Like, I should always avoid going on the House of Games or something.
Right.
Because I'll be like hammering the thing going, I know the answer. I don't know the answer. Because I can't stop myself doing that.
Well, okay, we should come to your fifth and final game. Can you tell us about it, please?
Yeah, the fifth final game. And again, it's representation of a whole bank of games. Because let's face it, I could have done tons of these. And I was sensitive to the fact that,
you know, somebody else will want to do Portal, or somebody else will want to do, you know, Half-Life or legendary GTA or whatever, these iconic games. I will say that the single greatest moment in gaming is still alive at the end of Portal, where that song comes on. That is the greatest piece of writing, storytelling in any, I think in any, like that would, that absolutely blew my mind when GLaDOS started singing.
Yeah, it was a good moment.
Oh, it's a fantastic thing. And I listened to it recently. It still stands up.
I've got Eric, who wrote that, coming on the podcast soon. So, yeah.
Whoa, listen, I pass on props to that, because that was just astonishing. It was just, and then you went, oh, this medium, oh, this is really, things are happening here. This is, you, they can do all sorts of things, like whatever. And it was just fabulous as a thing. But Garagoa is the one I've chosen. Garagoa is a it's on a iPad, so it's casual. I'm sure it's on other media as well, and it is a puzzle game whereby, again, you're presented with an image, but you can take portions of the image out and move it around to tell a story, which is never really fully. It's a story of an impending apocalypse and a monster attacking a small bison change. But you jump through time scales because you rearrange photo. You move it, you see a picture with a photo frame in it, and actually the frame will come, but the picture will stay. And then you end up using that frame to frame something else. And from that, an image comes out. So it's incredibly creative in how it goes from step, 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 and the puzzles and how they work. Because your character can only move if you rearrange the landscape around them by moving these very elegantly designed puzzle pieces around. So it's a beautiful game, and I've played through it a couple of times, and it's always a very pleasant, you know, just experience to go through it all. But it also represents for me to times when I'm not really in the mood to sort of launch into a 40-hour game. What's the 5-hour game or the 10-hour game? Or what's the, you know, it's one of those things that gaming does. I almost feel it was ahead of streaming and the TV production list, like whatever, going, okay, you want different experiences of different value, of different length. We will do that, and we'll put them at different price points, and then you can know what you're getting. That, but because there are ideas that are, they're good for 6 hours, they're not good for 40 hours, and so let's make the 6-hour thing, and then we'll sell that to you for $5.99 rather than for $45.99. I can do them. I travel a lot, I do them. I can do a short thing, whether it's, you know, The Room or Gorgoa or do something like Journey or Edith Finch.
Wonderful game, yeah.
Great game. And those kind of things, they're just a thing that this medium can do and no other medium can do.
Yeah.
So it's nice to be transported for that just for a while and just to go, right, well, this is what we get out of this. We don't have to create, not everything has to be a blockbuster. And there's maybe something in for television, you know, because it's at some point in reviews of certain series that have come out recently going, this is not an 8-hour idea. This is not a story that will last for 10 one-hour episodes. You know, this is, you know, maybe movies were 2 hours long. Maybe that's okay.
They were onto something.
Yeah, maybe they had a good idea. I mean, I think it's quite striking that the Oscars list this year is the most accessible of all the Oscar lists for a while, because it feels like people have actually seen movies, because there may be a reaction to, oh God, do I have to commit to 10 hours and then maybe there won't be an ending, or maybe Netflix will cancel this thing before it gets to the end. I won't find out whether this character, Jesus, just give us something to watch for, you know, that I know will come to a conclusion, like whatever. And it may be in a thicker way we're sliding back over to.
Yeah, that's so true.
I mean, things like poor old 1899, you know what I mean? Where I was about to watch it, and Ed had watched it and he said, oh, I'll just tell you the ending because it's not being renewed. So just skip to the ending.
Oh, that's tragic. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. You don't get to the stage where people are making like a one series or something, and then it doesn't get the numbers, and the one day it gets released on Netflix, and then they have to send an email out going, okay, look, that's not happening again. So Mary and John got married, and Bob died, and they just sent an email with, this is how all these characters, this is what we would happen with all these characters. Just a short bulletin of like, oh, remember those characters you loved? Yeah, they all died in an asteroid attack. Gaming has that ability to be just, okay, we'll slide into a gap.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, you've got a bit of time to do this. Here's a beautiful thing. Gargo was a wonderful example of that. It was one of those things that when the BAFTA nominations come out, things like that, I'd miss them.
And then the BAFTA would come along, and other award ceremonies are also available. And they would send me all the games in the 2 weeks before I host them. I hosted 10 times, I think it was 9 times. And they would, there was this period 2 weeks before the games where they would send me all the games. And sometimes you go, oh God, where are we now in Assassin's Creed? Which is fucking good.
Oh jeez, yeah.
I've got all of Greece or all of Rome to do. And then there'd just be download links for something like Origo, and you go, oh, perfect, lovely. That's absolutely delightful. Yeah, it's good. You get some sense of it. I remember once being in a hotel in Chester, and I had 3 nights of a gig in Chester. So I went down to Eddie, brought 2 machines down, and plonked them and plugged them all in, like whatever, and had this nest of USB cables all over the place. And I would do the show, walk back, and I would play. I had to play 20 different games for a while to get a sense of, so I could write a monologue about them. And it was weird. It was like, you know, it was like Sid and Nancy, you know what I mean? I'm in my dingy hotel room in the Chelsea Hotel, like whatever. I'm in a quite nice hotel in Chester, playing tons of video games for like 12 hours a day.
Yeah, guzzling Mountain Dew or whatever. Bro, well, thank you so much for your pick, Star. So we've got Pac-Land, Impossible Mission, ISS Pro, Arkham Asylum, and Gorogoa. I'm going to put you on the spot slightly and ask you if you can give a name to your console that we can market it as.
Oh, shit. God. You need to go Deathbox 9000, which, but have none of the games are like Call of Duty type stuff. It's all
gentle puzzlers.
It's all gentle puzzlers and sweet Nintendo games and Animal Crossing. It comes with Animal Crossing preloaded. The Deathbox 9000.
It's an unlock code, like the Pac-Land bonus. You can
Or probably more like the U2 album they stuck on the iPhone at the time that we got really angry about.
Well, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you. I just want to ask you one last thing before I let you go. So I think my platonic ideal listener is sort of slightly nerdy, quite bright and also witty, perhaps someone a bit like yourself, Tara. What advice would you give a young listener who maybe wants to follow a similar path to the one you've taken?
In terms of comedy, try it. It's the only way to do it. You have to stand in front of people and give it a go. Don't worry, you'll die. We all die. Yeah, everyone dies at the start, but you don't know until you've actually been there, because it's quite straightforward comedy. If you want to be in front of an audience, go and try to be in front of an audience. It does help if you're in certain population centres and all that, but there's a lot of stuff spoken about privilege and what school you went to and all that. That isn't really in stand-up comedy as much as it may have been in 1970s sketch comedy, but it's not just go to an open mic club and sign up and try it. And then try it and get as many minutes of stage time as you can. That's absolutely the most important thing. Find your voice. Any chance you get, just get in front of an audience. That's the single most important thing. I mean, and then go off and use that as an experiment and write more stuff. The arc of it is difficult to judge, but if you're just starting off, you've got to get the addiction first. Just, you know, once you have the addiction, then you're done. We have you, and you're in the gang once you've done that. So it's a case of getting as much stage time under your belt as possible, just to get a sense of who you are out there. And we've all done things. There's periods of time where, you know, you live in a house in London, you drive to Nottingham, you do 15 minutes on stage, you get back in the car, you drive down again, and you do the same to Southampton the following day. It can be a fun way to spend your 20s, but it also can be heartbreaking. So I have a bad throat because the last gig I did was in Svalbard in northern Norway.
Oh, right.
Which is a very dry place and very bad in your throat, among many other weird things about Svalbard, but we did a gig. So there's gigs popping up everywhere. And if there's a gig in Svalbard, there'll probably be a gig near you.
Dara, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your picks as well. It's been really wonderful to hear your perspective on games and everything. I super enjoyed it. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure.
Dara Breen, everyone. Wasn't that so good to hear his picks, his memories of playing games? Dara is, the week that this comes out, Dara is on tour in Norway. If you're in Oslo or Helsinki or Bergen, you can go and see him. And then he's back in the UK playing at Canterbury and Salford Quays later in February. Dara is pretty much everywhere, so you, I'm sure, will be able to find his material easily enough. Certainly go on YouTube and search up the video game routine that we were talking about right at the start of the episode. It's really a wonderful bit that, like he says, it's sort of become a signature part of his body of work. So definitely go and watch and listen to that. Thank you for listening this far into the podcast. I appreciate it. And thank you if you have subscribed, if you have left a rating or left a review. These things definitely help in these early days of the podcast. So yeah, if you have a spare moment and you haven't done those things, then I'd encourage you just to quickly go and do that. It will help me out, help the podcast out, and so that we can keep doing this. You can write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Thank you to those of you who have done so already with your thoughts and feedback, with your suggestions for future guests. That's been really useful and helpful to have. I've got a big master document of people that have agreed to come on and people that we'd like to ask to come on. So we'll be working through that throughout this year and hopefully the years to come. You can find me at Simon Parkin on twitter.com if you are still involved in that place. And you can also find the console at My Perfect Console with the O's removed. We'll be back next week with another fantastic guest with their 5 game choices and one more perfect console. Until then, have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.